Hello, this is World Business Report from the BBC World Service, where we bring you the latest in money, marketing, manufacturing, and yes, much, much more. Please review us, rate us, share us wherever you can. BBC podcasts are supported by advertising.
In the face of unprecedented disruption, it's become non-negotiable.
Companies are moving to what they call anti-fragile status.
I'm Chip Kleinexel, host of Resilient Edge, a business vitality podcast paid and presented by Deloitte and produced by BBC Storyworks Commercial Productions. Our third episode is about supply chain resiliency and what it takes for organizations to minimize their risk and improve efficiency. So watch out for episode 3 of Resilient Edge, coming soon wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. Namaste, I'm Divina Gupta, and it's a packed show. In a moment, it's a new government facing the old economic challenges in Sri Lanka. We will be speaking to the country's former finance minister about it. Then we head to India to find out why over 1,000 workers are on a strike at a Samsung factory for the past 2 weeks. And in the Democratic Republic of Congo, the impact of the mpox virus for businesses.
We had to put the three estates under quarantine. The transfer of experts who need to travel around the plantation has been greatly limited.
And as September brings the wine harvest for most of Europe, we hear how climate change is impacting producers.
21, 22, 23, 24, we have a big drought period, having half yield in the vineyards as an average.
All those stories here on World Business Report. But first, those are celebrations sparking after an intense weekend of anticipation across Sri Lanka that saw the NPP win the presidential election. The country's new president, Anura Kumar Dissanayake, is a left-wing politician who has promised change, cast himself as a disruptor of the status quo. And he's also promised a fresh start for all Sri Lankans.
We have a deep understanding that we have a challenging country. Our politics must be cleaner than this. There is a need for a political culture that people expect. We will commit ourselves to that. The public have a very negative view of politicians and politics.
Mr. Dissanayake, Sri Lanka's new president. Now, various business owners in Sri Lanka have been talking to us about what they hope from this new government. What is their view about economic change in the country that can help them?
My family and I run our own business trading in gems and jewellery for the past 4 decades in the tourism industry, which plays a massive role in foreign income earnings for our country. And recently, with certain taxations imposed, it has been quite a difficult road. With the new government, we hope that they hear what we have to say with our experiences in our industry and others in their respective industries.
Hi, my name is Darshan Munidasa, and I own restaurants in Colombo.
We deserve to be prosperous. We deserve to have peace. We deserve to show the world who we are, what we are. And for that, we need an administration that is dedicated to an economic program. We need to root out corruption. We need to root out nepotism.
I'm Dhruvi Gunasekara, founder of Boutiques in Sri Lanka. We've now got a new president, and one of his initial speeches, he spoke of tourism. Our hope is that he would understand the small luxury segment, as it is the fastest growing category of accommodation. It is also the segment that brings in high yield.
Now, some of those are expectations of the businesses in Sri Lanka. It's also the country which in 2022 saw that its foreign reserves had almost depleted. There was struggle for food, medicines, fuel. There were long queues on the streets. People were protesting. There was a political regime change as well. So now, what kind of economy is Mr. Dissanayake inheriting? I asked this question to the former finance minister of Sri Lanka, Iran Vikramaratne.
So they have inherited an economy where there is many people below the poverty line, and therefore there has to be some social stability, and therefore you'll have to rebalance, particularly in terms of the social net. You'll have to protect those at the bottom of the income scale. And therefore, even taxation on the details will have to be re-looked at. The other big challenge they will immediately have is to access markets. You need to get back on the ratings. To get back on the ratings, you will have to have your debt restructured. And this government will have to face up to that and get the debt renegotiated. So it has a lot of challenges.
So let's unpack it one by one, because first there is this big $3 billion loan from the International Monetary Fund that Sri Lanka had to take when its foreign currency reserves had dipped to an abysmal low just to keep the economy going. Now, this government wants to renegotiate that. How will that play out?
I think that, you know, what is said during an election cycle and what you do when you come into office, sometimes there is a gap. You can't change the broad parameters. After all, you're the borrower, they're the lender. It's just like going to anybody going to the bank with your project. And ultimately, you have to discuss it, and it has to be a win-win situation on both sides.
And then there are also external borrowers like India and China that have now given money to Sri Lanka. It will be a tricky balancing act for Mr. Dissanayake here.
Yes, it is always going to be a balance. We are a small island nation. We've always had to deal with geopolitics. Today, India has shifted and it's more on the western flank. And therefore, if our new government understands that, you see, and then I think that could be strengthened. On the other hand, Chinese have also contributed to Sri Lanka's economy over a period of time. And I think the government will be open to trading with China, investment from China, but taking into account really the security concerns of our largest neighbor, who is just a few kilometers away from our shores.
Now, earlier you also spoke about the price rise that people are facing in Sri Lanka right now. And this government has promised to lower taxes, lower utility bills. But can Sri Lanka's economy afford it?
Talking only about the giveaways, if I would put it like that, alone doesn't really help. So you will have to talk about how are you going to actually make good. So people who go to work, inflation has gone through the roof. Their cost has escalated over the last 2 years. But the incomes haven't gone up. They're never dependent on the state. That they live with dignity. They look after their families, their parents, grandparents. And you should make sure that that continues rather than pushing them to the wall and dependent on the state. So some relief there. And then relief, some relief in terms of the poor and the low earning groups. Now, what they haven't announced is, how are you going to make good? Give the tax relief. You have more revenue to collect. So one thing is for sure, the tax net can be expanded, but it takes time. The other is that you will have to introduce some taxes to take it from the people who can.
What kind of taxes do you think can be introduced? Because a World Bank report suggested that almost 60% of Sri Lankan households have seen reduction of work hours. There's also been job losses for them.
I think the agreement with the IMF suggests that you will have to look at other taxes to do with wealth and things like that. So if you are giving relief, obviously you'll have to collect it from somewhere else. So I think everybody should look at it positively, because social stability is a must for any government.
Many are viewing Mr. Dissanayake as an outsider who is there to challenge the status quo of the political elites. How difficult will be that road for him?
I think that he will have a lot of support if he sticks within the democratic framework, and if he sticks within the rule of law, and if he makes the justice system work. If he moves out of that, then I think it will probably lead to chaos, and eventually people will react because people are sick and tired of people who have robbed and stolen and hidden assets, you know, getting away, not being brought to book and not being brought to justice. You see, so the anti-corruption commission powers will have to be strengthened further, giving them investigative powers. Then stolen assets recovery, a law will have to be passed. We'll have to get international support on it. While these things may not collect you a lot of money, but they certainly will instill confidence, you see, that the rule of law actually works. Because if you're going to attract investment and foreign investment, that's a big barrier.
Iran Vikramaratne, former finance minister of Sri Lanka there, and work cut out not only for the new government in Sri Lanka, but many governments here in the Eurozone as well. Because business activity in the Eurozone contracted in September, hitting an 8-month low and undershooting forecast, according to an index which is closely watched by investors, S&P Global's Flash Purchasing Managers Index. And according to the numbers, it is at 48.9, which is down from 51.2 last month. So basically, the business activity has fallen further than expected for the Eurozone. Let's get in Rachel Winter, who's partner and investment manager at Killikin Company, to make a sense of this. Rachel, so it seems that it's Germany, which seems to be going down, and there's been a broad-based downturn there, because of which these numbers have been so dull.
Yeah, so for these purchasing managers' indices, any number less than 50 means that a contraction is expected. So any number less than 50 is definitely a bad thing. As you say, Germany is the largest economy in Europe, and Germany has really slowed down recently. A large part of that is the car sector. So Germany is very dependent on manufacturing cars, and that part of the economy has really slowed down. And a big part of that is electric vehicles. Consumers simply aren't buying them because the infrastructure isn't there.
And where do you think there could be growth if you look at these numbers? Because this seems to be indicating that Eurozone itself needs to find that sweet spot to revive manufacturing.
Well, manufacturing aside, Europe does have some strong sectors. So it does have some fantastic healthcare businesses. It does have some great technology businesses, for example, SAP. So there certainly are some bright points in the European economy.
And you talked about manufacturing of cars. Let's talk about the Swedish company Northvolt, which makes batteries for electric vehicles. It's set to cut about a quarter of its workforce. That's about 1,600 jobs. And that's why this number becomes more important, because this is the worry, job losses.
Yes, so the electric vehicle sector was doing very well up until about 2021. But since then, we've really seen a reduction in demand from consumers. And that's been really bad news for companies like Northvolt, which are totally dependent on the electric car sector. So the fact that they're having to cut jobs and they're also having to raise money, that just shows how difficult it has become for electric vehicle makers.
Rachel, stay with us on the show, because we'll be talking more about other markets as well. You're with World Business Report from the BBC World Service. Now, we've been covering the Mpox outbreak on the show. Since it was declared a global health emergency in August, there have been more than 29,000 cases and over 700 deaths that have been reported in the African continent. The Democratic Republic of Congo is one of the worst affected countries. There's been some progress there, such as delivery of 200,000 vaccines. But with a population of over 100 million, this is just a drop in the ocean. And with the growing transmission of this infection, businesses are having to reconsider how they can manage to continue their operations. Among them is Monique Gisquez, who's managing director of Plantacion e Willari du Congo, the DRC's largest palm oil producers with over 10,000 employees. She has been speaking to my colleague Alan Kasuja about how the company has been dealing with the outbreak.
The palm oil production is not located in the capital city. It is located in three different provinces, and those are located in the northeastern part of the DRC. Knowing that the Mpox epidemic is really coming from the rural areas and it reaches the main cities. So since our operations are so remotely located, and knowing that it's really coming from the remotely located areas, it was very important for us to put in place very urgent and important measures. The company has the largest healthcare facility in the country. We have four hospitals with 460 beds, three health centers, and 18 dispensaries.
So has Mpox affected your business operation?
Absolutely. First of all, we had to put the three estates under quarantine. It means that the traffic from Kinshasa to the three estates and the traffic between the estates had to be restricted and limited to my approval. And it means that, well, it is affecting because the transfer of colleagues, of experts who need to travel around the plantation has been greatly limited. In the meantime, we put in place all the safety protocols and preventive health measures in the estates.
So when you say preventive health measures, does that include vaccines?
We are waiting for vaccines, but at the moment, the preventive health measures are a bit the same as the COVID-19, meaning deploying additional temperature take, equipment, masks, drugs, communication material, the distanciation between people and also our employees in the plantation, our workers, harvesters, upkeep, maintenance employees. It also implies hand washing stations, disinfection of hands, gloves, masks.
You talked about waiting for the vaccines. That suggests to me that you've had a conversation about that and you're expecting them to come from somewhere.
Yes. So the national vaccines come from the government. So at the moment, the number of vaccines that they've received is very small. They've received 265,000 doses, which is not sufficient for the country. Honestly, we have approached the national, the government on that, and we're on the waiting list.
Do you think businesses like yours have an important role to play when there is a public health crisis?
Absolutely, because we are in direct contact with the population. The way our company is organized, we can easily partner with the government and support the government initiatives by first communicating with the communities and who live in rural areas so remotely. So I think we are a key partner of the government.
That was Monique Giskes, Managing Director of PHC, a company that produces palm oil in the Democratic Republic of Congo, speaking to my colleague Alan Kasuja. And you can hear this conversation on Africa Daily, wherever you get your podcasts. And now to the south of India, to the state of Tamil Nadu. Now, that's a sound from a protest site where more than 1,000 factory workers have been on a strike. This is against the Samsung factory in India. Since the 9th of September, these workers have gathered and been protesting against the management. The South Korean company makes home appliances at this factory in Tamil Nadu, which contributes a third of its $12 billion revenues from India. But its workers have alleged that they are being paid unfairly. They have been also made to work longer hours. Now, Samsung doesn't recognize a union in India, but the workers have assembled themselves under a national organization called the Center of Indian Trade Union, or CETU. I spoke with S. Kannan, who is the Deputy General Secretary of CETU. He joined me from the protest site in Tamil Nadu.
In India, 8 hours is working hours. But here in Samsung, employees are forced to work 10 hours. Another reason is, even after 17 years, the workers not able to get reasonable salary.
So when workers complained, how was their complaint addressed by the management?
That particular employee asked to sit in the isolated place. That kind of excommunication is also major mental agony for the each and every employee. That is why they came forward to form union.
Why is it that Samsung is opposing workers forming a union in India?
That committee, workman committee, is there.
So Samsung has an internal committee. But why not
internal
a union?
Committee. Those who are not... Yeah, that is what we are also asking. Committee is not having legal sanctity. Union is having the legal sanctity.
But not all workers are on strike. There are some workers who are still going to work. They don't want this.
Yeah, only 250 employees are inside. Even among some 40 girl women employees also expressed their dissatisfaction with the management.
And it's also the festive season, which is approaching in India, when people will be buying home appliances.
Yeah, you are right.
How much has the production been reduced right now in this factory?
As per our information, our employees have told that near about 70% of production have been cut off.
That says Kanuna, Deputy General Secretary of the Trade Union C2. They're supporting Samsung workers on strike. We have also got a statement from Samsung India. They've said, we categorically deny that workers are made to work for 4 hours at a stretch. All workers get suitable breaks in between. We are ready to communicate with the work council comprised of a majority of employees on the matters, including wages, benefits and working conditions. We are not open to negotiating with a union that is affiliated to the third party. Now, this September brings the wine harvest for major European wine producers, which this year have again seen their yields hard hit by climate change. While new wine regions are emerging with better growing conditions for traditional wine regions, drought and rising temperatures are posing a big challenge. Sophie Istag has been to Catalonia and has been able to see how one winemaker is adapting.
We are in Mas La Plana vineyard, so okay. Here we have very, very old vines in the area.
Josep Sabarich is the chief winemaker at Familia Torres, one of the oldest family wine companies in Spain. The family has been making wine here since 1870, but now it's facing a huge challenge.
21, 22, 23, 24, we have a big drought period, having half yield in the vineyards as an average in the area.
Wow. Yeah, so that's you had half as many grapes grown as a normal year.
Yes.
That's really serious.
Yeah, that's really serious, because when the drought periods are too long, another thing appears that was unexpected in the area. I never seen that, is the death of the plants. Some plants cannot survive.
Josep shows me vines that have shriveled up and turned brown. For the grapes that do survive, higher temperatures mean they ripen 2 weeks earlier, and that affects the taste and character of the wine.
The aromas are evolving from fresh or green fruit to ripe and then overripe and jammy fruits. You have more sugar in the grapes, so more sugar means more alcohol in the wines.
Wine growers like the Torres say climate change is an existential threat. In fact, a recent study found that 90% of traditional wine regions in lowland Spain, Greece, Italy, and Southern California could disappear by the end of this century if they don't adapt. The Torres family have started planting grapes at altitude to get away from the scorching heat.
We have been producing grapes in the Pyrenees at 1,000 meters. The benefit is if you go up, the temperatures are very low comparing to here, so that's good for the plants.
In a test vineyard, I saw one of their other strategies. In the early 19th century, a disease called phylloxera came from the USA and destroyed most of the native grapevines across Europe, including here in Catalonia. Most people thought they were lost forever, until now.
Sometimes we find just one old vine, sometimes we find a small plantation, and sometimes it's in the middle of the forest in a tree.
Mireia Torres is part of the family's fifth generation of winemakers. Using announcements in the local press, she's been leading a grape hunt across the region.
Then we have Charello, Bronza, Gonfals, Moneu, Solana, Querol, Tarragona.
Mireia's found 60 varieties so far, some of which are more resistant to drought and ripen later, which helps with higher temperatures. She hopes they'll be the climate-proof wines of the future.
And this is the Forcada. This is the white variety. It was an old lady that has several old vineyards, and we found more than one variety in these vineyards. So it was a very good day.
Finding the vine is just the start of a long 12-year process to get it checked for viruses and officially approved. As the world warms, you might start noticing more unfamiliar grape varieties on the market, as places like Spain try to keep the wine flowing. The good news is, they taste pretty good.
That's Sophie Eastor reporting there, and you can hear more on that on the Climate Question podcast. Find it on BBC Sounds or wherever you get your podcasts. to Australia now, where the country's consumer watchdog is suing their two big supermarket chains, Coles and Woolworths, after accusing them of falsely claiming to have dropped the prices of hundreds of items. The Australian Competition and Consumer Commission's chair is Gina Cass-Gottlieb.
We allege that Woolworths and Coles offered the products at regular long-term prices for 6 months or more, then increased the price for a short period before placing the products on the Woolworths prices dropped promotion or the Coles down promotion at prices higher than or the same as the prior regular price.
The grocery giants, which account for two-thirds of the Australian market, have come under increasing scrutiny in the past year over alleged price gouging and anti-competitive prices. Australians, like others across the world, have been struggling with the cost of living crisis. Gina Cass-Gottlieb says it's a serious accusation.
We're seeking a significant penalty. This is serious conduct that is of great concern to us, that affected many consumers with millions of products sold subject to this practice. That penalty has to be high enough to be not a cost of doing business for such major companies, to deter them from this conduct in the future and deter all retailers from this manner of conduct.
Now, Coles has said it would defend itself. Woolworths has said it would review the claims. There's more on this on bbc.com/news, but let's get a quick word in from Rachel Winter, who's been with us through the show. Rachel, these are big businesses with a large market share in Australia. How could this news have an impact on them?
Well, if they are found to be guilty of this, then I think it could be negative for both businesses. But sadly, I think it is not an uncommon practice worldwide. I think, for example, during the Black Friday sales, a number of retailers worldwide have been accused of raising their prices before the sale so they can then say something is cheaper in the Black Friday sale. So I think it is something that does require a global crackdown.
Or could it be a global crackdown at all with these market practices, or more self-regulation is needed? But with that question, we end it here. Rachel Winter, Partner Investment Manager at Killick & Company. You've been listening to World Business Report with me, Davina Gupta. See you next time. Namaste.
In the face of unprecedented disruption, it's become non-negotiable.
Companies are moving to what they call anti-fragile status.
I'm Chip Kleinexel, host of Resilient Edge, a business vitality podcast paid and presented by Deloitte and produced by BBC Storyworks Commercial Productions. Our third episode is about supply chain resiliency and what it takes for organizations to minimize their risk and improve efficiency. So watch out for episode 3 of Resilient Edge, coming soon wherever you get your podcasts.